No verse up. So what I'll do is I'll just read it. I didn't prepare for this particular verse. It's all changed at the last minute. So what I will do is I will actually talk about what I prepared for, and maybe bring something in on this verse that I haven't even actually read yet. Pardon? Yeah. What was it? What number? 31.
And then there is no purpose, so this is 32-33.
Yeah, I'll just read the translation for that. Okay. Yata hi Bhagavan eva vastuta sad asag cha yat satyena anena na save yantu nasham apadrava yatahi bhagavan eva vastuta sat achachayat. Sorry, I'll go a little more. Vastuta sad asakchayat satyena nena nasave yantu nasham apadrava. Shall I do word-for-word translation? Yata, just, yata, okay, sorry. This is translation by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Srila Prabhupada. The subtle and gross cosmic manifestation is material, but nevertheless it is non-different from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because He is ultimately the cause of all causes. Cause and effect are factually one because the cause is present in the effect. Therefore, the absolute truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, can destroy all our dangers by any of His potent parts. Verse 32 and 33, there's no purport to that one. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, the living entities, the material energy, the spiritual energy, and the entire creation are all individual substances. In the ultimate analysis, however, together they constitute the Supreme One, the Personality of Godhead. Therefore, those who are advanced in spiritual knowledge see unity in diversity. For such advanced persons, the Lord's bodily decorations, His name, His fame, His attributes, and forms, and the weapons in the hands are manifestations of the strength of His potency. According to their elevated spiritual understanding, the omniscient Lord, who manifests various forms, is present everywhere. May He always protect us everywhere from all calamities. The purport. A person highly elevated in spiritual knowledge knows that nothing exists but the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is also confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita 9.4, where Lord Krishna says, Maya tatam idam svavam, indicating that everything we see is an expansion of his energy. This is confirmed in the Vishu Purana 1252, Akadashi Shtita Shyagna Jyotishna Vishtadini Yata Parashya Brahmana Shaktish Tatidam Akilam Jagat. As fire, although existing in one place, can expand its light and heat everywhere, so the omnipotent Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, although situated in his spiritual abode, expands himself everywhere, in both the material and spiritual worlds, by his various energies. Since both cause and effect are the Supreme Lord, there is no difference between cause and effect. Consequently, the ornaments and weapons of the Lord, being expansions of his spiritual energy, are not different from him. There is no difference between the Lord and his variously presented energies. This is also confirmed in the Padma Purana. Nama Chintamaniya Kina Krishna Chaitanya Rashna Vigraha Puna Sudho Nicha Mukto Binatvan Nama Namino. The holy name of the Lord is fully identical with the Lord, not partially. The word Puna means complete. The Lord is omnipotent and omniscient, and similarly, his name, form, qualities, paraphernalia, and everything pertaining to him are complete, pure, eternal, and free from material contamination. The prayer to the ornaments and the carriers of the Lord is not false, for they are as good as the Lord. Since the Lord is all-pervasive, he exists in everything, and everything exists in him. Therefore, even worship of the Lord's weapons or ornaments has the same potency as worship of the Lord. Mayavadis refuse to accept the form of the Lord, or they say that the form of the Lord is Maya or false. But one should note very carefully that this is not acceptable. Although the Lord's original form and his impersonal expansion are one, the Lord maintains his form, qualities, and abode eternally. Therefore, this prayer says, Patu Save Svarupaya Na Sada Savrata Savaga. May the Lord, who is all pervasive in his various forms, protect us everywhere. The Lord is always present everywhere by his name, form, qualities, attributes, and paraphernalia, and they have all equal power to protect the devotees. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Now, I was put in a predicament, as you can see, because I didn't prepare at all for this verse and chapter. And I'm not one of those learned speakers that can just speak from heart and mind. I need to prepare. So I'm a little perplexed as to what to do. But I would like to speak about what I prepared earlier, which was actually... It was going from verse 21 through to 30. So this is my brain, I haven't got one yet, so going back to 21 through to 30, actually that the whole chapter, or I should say the Srimad Bhagavatam itself, it presents two major themes which is consistent throughout, which is one of protection and one of glorification. So there is actually an additional theme here, which is in this particular chapter, which is talking about approaching a spiritual master. And it's quite appropriate given the nature of Lord Indra's offense against his spiritual master. So when you make a boo-boo, as they say, like Lord Indra, they've dedicated this whole chapter now to Lord Indra coming very much appropriately towards a spiritual master, Vishwarup. So what can we learn here? That the undefeatable, the king of all kings, never mind the fact that this world and the kind of empire that we have, but this is Lord Indra, the king of heaven. He's approaching a spiritual master for protection. So we can learn that that's our position too, because more than ever, we're very insignificant. We need that protection. So, but being as he was a demigod, demigods have that slight material attachment, and he realized throughout that all his wealth, all his opulence, and all his power was under serious threat. Well, in fact, it had been taken away. So there's a point here where Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita was being persuaded by the Lord to hold on to his opulences. This was one argument that Krishna used. It wasn't the highest argument, but it was presented that way. And so Arjuna, let me think. What I'm trying to say is that it was okay to be approaching a spiritual master for some level of material attachment, some material opulence, some material benefit. And I wonder, when we see our position here, that we can see all of the disease, all of the war, the fear here, that there's so much crime and pain, but how many of us actually ask for protection in this way? It's quite serious. We might think of a welfare agency to sort of help us out, but everything appears safe. Right now we feel safe. So what's in force right now is the police force, the army. They're there. If they weren't there, we wouldn't be in this position now. That's how dangerous this world is. So why do I say that? So, just like to welcome His Grace Janivas Prabhu. Hare Krishna. No, I really don't know what to say. So yes, I was saying that everything appears to be safe, but when you think about it, this is the position of the whole upper planetary system. That it's a big time disaster. It's very scary. Everyone in the upper planetary system, everyone is in fear, because the demons had invaded and taken everything. So, if there wasn't this danger, however, it is a boon. If there was this danger, we wouldn't for a minute think to get out of here. So it's it has its place. So, and then when you look throughout the whole of this chapter, it's all about praying for protection. This is the scientific way in context with the laws of God. This is a science to pray for protection. There is a method, and it was presented particularly through this chapter how much Lord Indra was glorifying the Lord. And in addition to that, can we see the animals? Do they have the same position to pray for protection? Can they chant various mantras? No, not at all. So we are no different to animals. Just like the animals, yes, they may want that protection. They may look for safety, but they cannot get it. So they have no means. They are simply the prey for each other. So this is the human position, to be praying for protection. And it gives us an insight again and a picture of in the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna is on the chariot. And how do they reach that position of being a Maharatha? I was fascinated by all these soldiers' gradations. And the Maharatha, he's an expert in the science of warfare. And Lord Indra is in that position. One can fight alone against thousands of soldiers all at once. And so what does it mean that he is expert as how to get that title, that expertise of Maharatha? Is that he's expert in chanting on the mantras. This is his armor. It's mystic armor. And Arjuna had arrows coming from all directions. But I remember how many people went to the play last week. Quite a few. The position of Arjuna fighting, he was in hiding, incognito, in the kingdom of King Virat. And that's one of my favorite pastimes of the Mahabharata, mainly because it presents in amongst all of the pain and politics and danger and the violence. There's this comedy scene with Arjuna as a eunuch, and there's a description of him running across the field after he defeats by himself the nature of this Maharat, by himself the whole entire army of Duryodhana, and then he's running across the field in disguise, but just letting you know that was my favorite scene because of that. I also, coming from a Western background, coming from Catholic come Christian sort of practice, these scriptures, these teachings are all very new to me. And when I first came across the Mahabharata, actually it was on the TV, and I was about 12 years old or 13, I was thinking that this Mahabharata, this is just olden times, back in history. This is just bows and arrows, and there's no real sophistication here. That this is not any sort of hero story for a boy today, and I was that boy preferring the sophistication and technology of a soldier or war today, if there was anything to admire by it. But I had the look upon the Mahabharata as boring, and I preferred the fighter jets and torpedoes and heat-seeking missiles, all this kind of today's technology. And I wasn't that excited about seeing a load of elephants and swords. So I thought, give me tanks. And that's what I call a war story. And but then I was later to find out, purchasing my first Bhagavad Gita 10 years ago, that the position of mantras and how important they are, if you believe them, that is. That's the real key, if you actually believe in the power of mantras. And I had no reason to doubt them. It appears that we've lost so much in this world. So the idea of these mantras producing thousands of arrows from one arrow. Then I started to see the war, or the power of the war, in a very different way, the power of these soldiers. And the funny thing is that it's just Arjuna or any particular bowman, he's got just a few arrows in the back, and they just stay there, constantly replaced, firing, replaced. And this was, as I say, very mystic. And then reading, well, we do have, as it says in the Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, that we do have fire weapons at hand today. But there were also water weapons. And that's something unbelievable, to think that you're fighting. We can fight with water. We're fighting fire with water as firemen. But to see how that operated from a mantra, it was a very mystical, I mean, the special effects of this, as it were, as it would appear. I put myself into the context of seeing it like a movie, and then one can imagine what it was really like. I think it was actually mentioned in the Mahabharata that the whole sky was black. It was turned to night through the amount of arrows that were in the sky, just covering the whole battlefield. Why to mention this? Going back to 31, it talks about bringing the auspiciousness to, this is what Indra is calling for. He's praying for this protection, the auspiciousness of his position. And he can only do that through glorifying Narayan. And the auspiciousness, can anybody tell me the auspicious signs, the signs of victory that were in the Bhagavad Gita? So I think there was something like five. Name me the five symbols or signs, starting with Hanuman flag. Anyone else? Hanuman flag. The five auspicious signs that made that war auspicious. It was the Hanuman flag. I'll just give you one. Come on. There was Krishna himself. If he was on the side of the Pandavas, this made it auspicious. There was by Agni, the chariot that could go all sides and not be defeated. There was the goddess of fortune. So wherever Krishna is, the goddess of fortune is there. So that was another one. The battle of Kurukshetra itself had been a sacred place from different pastimes. And so that was also auspicious. This was Duryodhana's biggest fear about the outcome of the war. And the last one I've forgotten, although the last one I've forgotten. I can't remember it now. Did I write it down here? I didn't write it down. Anyway, there was five. There's another part to this battle. This is the nature of Lord Indra's position, that it had to be a holy war by inciting these mantras. We have many wars today, but none of them are holy. The Muslims themselves, they're always presenting that they're fighting a holy war. So it's very important, if you are going to be fighting, that you're actually your principles and reasons are for restoring religious principles. This was the nature of the Bhagavad Gita. But I just thought you might like to know what. We have wars today, and I checked out the theory some time back, but they're called just wars. Just, meaning there's some moral relative justice there, that it's the right thing to do to protect citizens, to preserve their rights, but they don't go beyond this moralistic platform. And then jihad, that word jihad strikes nowadays a little bit of fear into people, because it's been taken out of proportion, that word, and it's often presented as just being to fight, to go to war, but that's actually the last point of call that anybody refers to operates on. That the word jihad actually. Harb means war, but jihad means is a holy struggle by Muslims. So it's more an inner struggle. So we can relate with that, the very war against Maya, that inner struggle, that survival for becoming spiritual, becoming pure. They have struggle against evil, which is through the speech and the writing. So to make sure that the right kind of information is going out. There was also, oh yes, and the last one, as I mentioned before, there's a struggle by the hand. How does it say it here? It says, refers to a struggle of good against evil waged by actions of one's wealth, such as going on the Hajj pilgrimage. Seen as the best jihad for women. taking care of elderly parents, providing funding for jihad, political activity, etc. And as I say, the last one is jihad by the sword. So I just thought I'd mention that. That when we talk about creating auspiciousness, in these verses from 21 to 30, the incarnations are mentioned of the Lord in terms of praise, constantly calling upon the names of Narayan. And Arjuna, you'll find, did the same. You'll find that was presented in the Bhagavad Gita with Hrishikesh. He referred to Krishna as the controller of the senses and was directing him over the battlefield. There was also Madhusudan, because Krishna killed the demon Madhu. So there was quite a few names. I can't say this so easy. Apratitam Prabhava, one of incomparable glory. Arisudan, destroyer of the enemy. All these, there were so many names, something like 30 different names given to Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. And it's important. This is a way. This is a way of bringing Krishna into the center of one's activities. The four varnas, being the brahmanas, the satriyas, the vaishyas, and the sudras. This is the way that to bring the ruling class into line, that they also have to pray. They also have they may be given all of the powers to look after society, but the nature of calling upon these prayers in this way, to beg for protection, to call upon this mystic armor, keeps them in their place in terms of making sure that they remember the Lord. The other varnas also need to do the protecting as well. So the brahmana class of a society as a whole, in terms of bringing them back to the Lord, and also the vaishyas. And their principal position is to protect the animals, and particularly the cows. Where shall I go now? That I discovered something recently that Tretika Yuga only came about. Tretika Yuga came about through King Purava, and he was after some. He wanted to perform yajna, previously yajnas had been just principally for the glorification of the Lord and to get liberated and back to the Lord. But at this particular junction, King Purava was very infatuated with Urvasi. And in fact, he was made to appear somewhat a pathetic figure in the end by being so intoxicated with the need of sense gratification. But at this particular point, he wanted a child or many children by Urvasi, and he was praying to get to meet her once again. And he performed yajnas. Although he was performing yajnas, he was constantly thinking about Urvasi. So he wasn't doing it in the best mindset. But again, I'm illustrating the position of the demigods here, that they weren't actually praying for pure liberation, for pure love of God. They were actually praying, or Lord Indra's position there was to, as I said at the beginning, hold on to his opulences. There was some material attachment. However auspicious it might appear by all of the chanting of these mantras, there was an agenda there. Let me just go through. verse 31 actually talks about the Lord is called Avyagyan, indicating that there is no difference between him and his names, forms, qualities, weapons, and so on, as reading in those those next two verses. This is the beginning of that particular presentation. And Avyagyan means knowledge without duality. So simply by hearing and chanting and thinking of the Lord, worshipping the Lord, one can see him and one can feel his presence by understanding Avyagyan. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu. So even when we speak of Lord Vishnu, we also refer to what relates to Vishnu. So there is a point in one of these verses where Lord Indra is praying to become the personification of the mantra itself. And talks in another verse leading up to that the Maha Mantra is the most powerful. So something else I learned recently in a lecture from His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj was that in Satya Yuga there was the holy name, the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, and everyone knew of it, but because it was so simple, they actually neglected to actually recite it, and they believed that they said, "Oh, that's easy, you know, for them at that particular time. We can do this. It's Hare Krishna, it's no problem." So they actually chose to retire, well, not so much retire, but renounce and go completely in that way and go to the caves and perform very difficult austerities, Ashtanga yoga for 60,000 years or whatever their lifespan would give them. They could live up to 100,000 years. So the Maha Mantra was there at that time, and they neglected it. That's however elevated they were, they didn't see it, that they had the ability, more than any of us, to perform it, yet they ignored it. So now, this is all we have to rely on in this particular age. This is what we have. This is the yajna for this age. This is the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. Now, all these verses are talking about asking for protection. And this was Lord Indra's position because he was going to war. So the emphasis here that he has to chant these mantras in order to get protection. And he's approaching a spiritual master in that way. He's realized his mistake from the previous chapter where he offends Brihaspati. And now, with everything taken away, all his powers, he's got this opportunity to chant these mantras within his particular vana, to fight And this is why these mantras were created that way, so that one can utilize them with one's particular nature. Now, we might not have any particular nature left at all ourselves, but the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra is our position, in as much as we are helpless. We have got nothing here. We're powerless, and yet we don't see it. And if Indra can say he's powerless at that particular point, that there is so much fear and danger from the demons, from taking everything away. And then look what's happening to us now. This is what's going on. Your taxes is unbelievable. There is a time when we will have to run to the hills, but we'll probably, even the Brahmanas, even ourselves, will be forced to run to the hills at a certain point, because it's no longer livable here. So I'd like to end here on that note, that protection comes through glorification of the Lord, and one must see the importance of mantras, and not just being a ritual, because certainly if you're preparing for war, you would want to make sure that you are reciting those mantras to the best of your ability. And this was Indra's position, that he had to make sure that that armor, that mystic armor, it worked. And we have also the need for that mystic armor, just with this simple mantra, one mantra. And coming from a Western background, it's that simple. I've discovered that if that's all it takes, then I'm going to chant it for the rest of my life. And I can see desperately the need for that mystic armor. This is what we can learn from this, that when we're chanting on our beads, this is the Yuga Dharma for this age. So I'd like to end there, if I may. If there's any questions at all, nothing too difficult, I hope. Please fire away. Okay, so we'll finish there. Can I tell our Shri Bhagavatam? Chalai.